Welcome back to Innovation Hub. I'm Kara Miller. 2 years ago, the FDA approved a cheek swab that, in about half an hour, will tell you if you have AIDS. This year, the Mayo Clinic rolled out a test for colon cancer that you can do at home. And there's lots more to come. The experience of sitting on vinyl seats, waiting to get your blood drawn, may be over. Soon, self-diagnosis could mean a quick trip to the drugstore. Dr. Eugene Chan is the CEO of the DNA Medicine Institute. He has been working on a small self-analysis tool called the R-Health, which aims to do everything from testing your vitamin levels to diagnosing the flu. Also joining us is Professor Andrew Ellington from the University of Texas. Thanks to both of you for being here.
Thank you.
Great to be here.
So, Andrew, let me start with you and just sort of lay this out for me. I know we're used to doing certain kinds of tests at home. So obviously, pregnancy tests, glucose level, people can test at home. But it seems like I've been reading about a bunch of new diagnostic tests on the horizon. What is a world going to look like where we can do all sorts of at-home tests?
I think that's a great question because that world could have existed a long time ago. There's nothing particularly special about a pregnancy test or even a glucometer. They both are great devices, and they've been reduced to, you know, commercial practice. But the underlying technologies should allow you to test for a wide variety of things, for flu, for drugs of abuse, for any of a variety of things that you might want to know about your or someone else's life. And yet it hasn't really been penetrant, and it's not clear why, but I think that the technology has always been there. And really, we get to ask this question of ourselves. What do we want our medical care to be like, and how much do we want it to be in our own hands versus in the hands of a clinician?
Okay, but people have been doing pregnancy tests at home for a long time. Why aren't they doing flu tests at home? Why hasn't that gotten commercialized?
You know, my answer to that question may not be everyone's answer, but what was great about pregnancy tests is there was a huge social driver in the 70s for women being able to monitor their own health. They didn't want to always have to go to the doctor's office for something that should be routine, that they should be able to monitor themselves. I think it's more a perspective. Do we want to be able to monitor ourselves for flu? I'm not sure that, you know, your average American does, even though, you know, it could be useful. And so I think that there has to be a driver for it. And that driver, if it's not just, you know, the public wants it, should come in the form of how, you know, the public participates in medical care. Do you get a break on your insurance if you have your own flu test? Are you able to better channel medical resources if you can tell your doctor a little more about what you know about yourself?
Dr. Eugene Chan, you've been working on essentially this book-size gizmo that can test all sorts of stuff. In 5 years, what's the average consumer going to be able to test at home that they can't test at home now?
So in 5 years, there's a very comprehensive set of individuals focused on being able to democratize your vital signs. And that's an FDA-approved indication. So it's not like a fitness tracker. It's not like a sleep monitor. Those give pseudo-information. It's not very medically actionable, and I can't really do anything with it. But once you get to the FDA level of quality, the gold standard and quantitative accuracy of being able to perform EKG, being able to perform pulse oximeter, being able to measure respiratory rate, being able to measure atrial fibrillation when your heart is not beating properly. You know, once we put this whole medical framework around it and you're getting as accurate data, then that's when we're going to start seeing sort of a sea change in terms of how people manage their own health.
You're going to be giving yourself an EKG at home?
You can, absolutely.
Okay, so Andrew Ellington, I'm going to push this over to you. When you can do an EKG at home, what does the average person do with that information? I mean, pregnancy is clear, right? You're pregnant or you're not. An EKG, I mean, I don't have a medical doctor living in my house. So what do you do with the results of that test?
Right. Well, I'm not a medical doctor either. I'm just a biochemist. But it strikes me that, again, you know, depending upon what consumer demand will drive, that will be what the test will be useful for. But I strongly suspect that Eugene and others will come up with not just the ability to monitor, but apps that interpret what those signs are and begin to take the baseline for any individual or even for a population, look for outliers that give you better indication of, hey, maybe, you know, you are having incipient Alzheimer's, maybe you will have a heart attack in the future because things don't look quite right. I think once we baseline our health, that gives us a great opportunity to begin to look for any of a variety of disease indications longitudinally and to catch things really, really early. And that's not just true for vital signs, that's true for a variety of molecular indicators as well, being able to look for colon cancer early or other diseases where we'd really rather treat them before they become a huge problem.
Do you see people doing colon cancer tests at home? I know there's now a swab you can do in your mouth to see if you have AIDS. Right. Do you see people saying, you know, I want to test for AIDS or colon cancer at home?
Right. So I think people do want to test for these things. The question then becomes, what happens with the interpretation? One of the reasons I think that HIV tests have only recently become available over the counter is, what happens if you're positive? Or even worse, what happens if you're false positive or false negative? What are the consequences of that? And I think that's one of the reasons the medical community wants to keep these tests a little closer to home, because they're the ones who are going to have to provide the advice and treatment about the outcome of a given test. But if we assume that that's not necessary, then the more the better, as far as I'm concerned. I want to know a lot about my health. I want to know if there's a disease on the horizon that I can potentially treat, even if it means a wasted trip to my doctor's office. I'd rather know that I don't have cancer and that the test was false than that I might have an early stage cancer.
Eugene Chan, do you hear pushback from doctors? I know you are a doctor, but do you hear pushback from doctors of like, you know, we don't want people finding out at home that they have colon cancer and just kind of not knowing what to do with that information and completely flipping out, because that's a very, very scary thing to find out, you know, in your bathroom. Do you sort of get that feedback from colleagues of yours?
One of the most common questions that we've gotten is the role of the physician going to be obsolete with a technology like the R-Health? So we originally started working on the R-Health technology with NASA for long-duration space travel. And so as an astronaut is hurtling towards Mars, how do you...
They want to check to see their physical fitness.
Absolutely. You want to be able to check to see if space radiation damage levels in your bloodstream is high. You want to be able to see if your cardiac rhythms have been perturbed by external ionizing radiation, and et cetera, et cetera. So, but, you know, a whole part of that technology is sort of self-guided and autonomous diagnosis. So once you get the information, then what do you actually do with that information? How do you guide the individual? There's a whole psychological aspect to it as well. You know, I know an individual who had atrial fibrillation, and if they had one of these technologies where you can do home testing of EKG and be able to monitor on your smartphone for 72 hours or a week, they would have been able to pick up the fact that he had atrial fibrillation, you know, which ultimately led to a stroke, which ultimately could have been prevented. So there's a whole host of different medical diseases where potentially you can prevent them from happening if you're able to collect enough information. And if you're, let's say, I'll kind of move on to the scientific world a little bit. So let's say you have a lot of individuals who are testing a variety of cancer biomarkers in their own homes, and they share that information, and they create this whole network of crowd science. And suddenly certain biomarkers are now correlated with cancer or not, then that's going to be very powerful, because you're going to get information on a day-to-day basis, maybe hourly by hourly basis. And if people are enthusiastic and want to be able to take care of themselves, they're going to uncover new ways to potentially treat the diseases.
So you're talking
Absolutely.
About having a whole bunch of people who sort of go out there and gather data on a really large scale.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, so it's sort of way beyond the largest clinical trial that anybody's ever seen.
Absolutely. So, you know, what we're thinking about is certainly if you've got a collective population of individuals, you know, we're talking, you know, hundreds of millions and billions of individuals who have access to a cheap device, you know, we're talking several hundred bucks, and now you've got the ability to look at a wide range of different types of biomarkers, the world's going to be different.
Andrew Ellington, get in here. I mean, if everybody is sort of contributing their biomarkers for cancer and their EKG results to some sort of large cloud of data, how does that change things?
It changes things hugely, I think. And I'm sure Eugene has thought deeply about this, probably more deeply than I have. But for me, one of the things that changes, surprisingly, is actuarial tables. This is going to change how we deliver health insurance, because we're going to be able to much more finely think about who is in what risk category and how you even move around between risk categories depending upon the baseline data from your monitoring. And that's not to say that there'll be winners and losers. It just means that we'll be able to much better distribute resources across the entire healthcare system and across, you know, via insurance, so that we can basically make it to where monies go to risk and people collect monies so that they can best deal with risk. So that's one of the I think positive outcomes I see is right now we don't even know how to best categorize risk. We sort of do it on a very long-term basis, and then health insurance is for those catastrophes and crises that arise. If we can anticipate those catastrophes and crises, catch them when they're early, and distribute resources accordingly, that changes, you know, a huge sector of the economy. So I'm excited about the kind of work Eugene is doing and others are doing, because it's not just the democratization of healthcare. It really, to me, will change the underlying economics of the system.
Does it mean to you that people are going to spend less time at their doctor's office, at the hospital? Because, I mean, after all, if we couldn't test glucose levels at home and we had to go into the hospital to do it every time, I mean, the hospitals would be even busier than they are.
Yeah, and so I think that's right. We will reduce the load on the classic healthcare system, but it's going to be up to the consumer what they feel comfortable with. And I think that in turn will arise from how the data is used and how crowds emerge to use that data. You know, if an app allows you to get together with your 100,000 bestest friends and see what risk markers you have, and you can, you know, lobby for a change in insurance rates based on that, that's a good driver. If it's just sort of like, oh, this is, you know, healthcare Candy Crush, then maybe not so much, right? If there's not really a good strong driver, if it's just a flash in the pan in terms of being an amusement, then I don't think that's going to get as far as if we can really fundamentally change how we pay for and deliver healthcare.
Eugene, how does this change what doctors do, what your relationship is with your doctor?
So ultimately, this is, you know, what Andrew is saying is ultimately all this boils down to the cost of healthcare. So ultimately, you know, by having more and greater access to technology, you're hopefully going to be able to lower the cost of healthcare. You know, we've certainly, as the United States, we spend too much money on healthcare. And, you know, going back to the question, you know, that I always get from people is like, Eugene, you know, is this technology going to replace your physician? And the answer is no. It's going to create this very collaborative environment with your physician, where between visits, he's going to be able to pull up, you know, via secure login, all the data that you've gathered between the several months of visit that he's seen you. And so you'll be able to track every single EKG value, heart rate value, every type of biomarker. And individuals, if they're disciplined about it, they should be able to even write down certain lifestyle things they did during that day and say, hey, you know, I ate a banana and therefore my platelets are low. And 3 days later, I ate another banana and my platelets are low. I mean, obviously, that's a very simplistic example. Mm-hmm. And then the doctor is able to pull it up and be able to see, hey, potentially there's a trend here and let's run an experiment and look at yourself and your data. And let's see if we remove that variable, what happens to your health. So ultimately, you're going to have a more collaborative relationship with your physician and you're going to have better care.
I know you created your diagnostic tool in some sense for NASA. You mentioned people sort of hurtling out into space. They can't really go to the doctor. But how does this affect countries where maybe there aren't that many doctors, where people live in remote places? It's not that easy for them to test something about themselves, to give themselves the EKG, as we were saying, to give themselves the EKG. So, you know, they can't go to a hospital. So how does that change things, having sort of this little diagnostic tool around?
So certainly low resource settings have a very good analogy to space. And so the way that we've kind of looked at it is that if we solve the space challenge, then we're going to solve the remote setting in rural China and rural India, in remote parts of Africa, even in the U.S. You know, just to give you a very simplistic example, I was flying on an airplane out to L.A. and someone pressed a button, you know, hey, is there a doctor on board? And I happened to sit right next to him. And ultimately, as a physician in that circumstance, you feel extremely powerless because you just don't have the types of tools that you can to intervene and find out exactly what is wrong with the patient so that you can start interventions. And ultimately, the plane landed. And if I could tell the EMTs coming on board, hey, you know, this is what you have to bring in terms of meds, you know, this is exactly what you have to do, I believe the outcome of the patient would have been different.
Andrew, when you look at where this is all going, are there aspects of sort of bringing the doctor's office to your house that concern you, either in terms of privacy or in terms of, you know, how families start to interact because they have this information? Like, is there anything about this that gives you pause?
Sure. I mean, you know, the more we know about ourselves, the more we know about ourselves, both good and bad. And you've already pointed out a couple of obvious concerns, you know, privacy or, you know, what have you inherited from your folks? Who are you and how do you relate to your brothers and sisters and cousins and how are you different? So, you know, we're used to genetics defining us a little bit, but we live in a world where genetics doesn't completely define us, where our individual characteristics, our backgrounds, our education, and just, you know, our grit makes us who we are. And so one concern is when we do make the world much, 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 much more quantitative, when we have baseline data on everybody, you know, is it more like Gattaca, where everybody is always compared to everybody based upon their ladders? I mean, I like the tricorder example, that's fiction, but fiction is this great leader of thought. It tells you where things could go. And so I think that there are concerns, but again, I think the nice thing is, at least in this society, we probably get to define what those concerns are. There's already a lot of pushback on how much healthcare information should or should not be private versus public, and how, if you agglomerate information, you know, do you get to mine that information, and who gets to mine that information? And I think those are great conversations, and they should be occurring right now because of the future that's coming, where there will be so much more of that information available.
Andrew Ellington is a professor at the University of Texas, Austin. Dr. Eugene Chan is the CEO of the DNA Medicine Institute. Thanks so much to both of you for this conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you.